This Biz News briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees. Well, this is my last contribution on the briefing for a week. I'll be in London next week at the Association of Responsible Citizens Conference, and hopefully we'll be able to send you some information from there, but most definitely we'll be able to talk about it when I return. Of course, you'll be in the very capable hands of my colleague Bronwyn Nielsen throughout next week. But let's get on to today's Biz News briefing, and we kick off with Aaron Banks. Here's an interesting individual. He's a close friend and financial supporter of Nigel Farage, who has become the shooting star of British politics. In the most recent YouGov poll, and they do them pretty much every day in the UK, his Reform Party, the new party, the successor, if you like, to UKIP, has become the biggest or the most popular party in the UK, bigger even than the Labour Party. It's a fascinating discussion with Aaron Banks, who knows South Africa well. He grew up here, up until primary school anyway. Didn't go to school here, went to school in the UK. His father was working in Swaziland. He is British, and he's also, together with Farage, very close to Donald Trump. So, of course, I asked him how he views, and maybe if he had some inside knowledge on the Trump stroke Musk attack on the ANC here in South Africa.
I think you've got to split it into two parts. I think if we take Trump first, I genuinely think he's going to try to realign the geopolitics of the whole world. And I think the weakness in US leadership led to BRICS and led to this kind of China-Russia type alliance. So if you want my opinion, I think what will happen is he'll try to wrap up the Ukraine war very quickly, probably within the next month or two, with some sort of territorial compromise. The war will end. And I think he'll try to bring Russia back towards the West rather than pushing them towards China. And I think the Americans, Trump in particular, sees China as the real enemy. That's the one that has to be confronted. Because economically, China is strong. Russia is weak economically. It's not a first world power. So I think that's what he's going to try and do. And I think Africa will be at the white heat of this kind of geopolitical realignment, which makes South Africa's position very interesting. Because I think he's going to really take the BRICS thing on head on. And I think the ANC have got real problems with their kind of Iranian connections, all the bad things they've done over the years. It's all going to come chipping up. And I think the Americans are going to go full guns blazing to pick the Chinese out of Africa, for want of a better description, and bring the Russians back inside and realign geopolitically. So I think to South Africa, it sits right in the middle of this. It's definitely interesting.
You mentioned Iranian connections. What do you understand by that, and why is that so important to the Americans?
I think Iran's going to be enemy number one. And I think the ANC, huge breaks into the various other things, so have been dabbling the, you know, things they shouldn't have been dabbling the. I think that's going to be a very problematic thing here. The Americans are back, and they're robust, and they're looking to take issues on there. I think they view the whole west coast of Africa as strategically important. It'll be interesting, I think, alignment. I think there's only one politician actually in South Africa at the moment really gets it. It's probably Gaetan McKenzie, who's an interesting character. But, you know, you can see actually as well that he's probably the only one that's actually saying, let's engage with the Americans, let's see what's what.
He could be the Nigel Farage of South Africa, perhaps?
I think he's got the potential to be the president of South Africa. And as we know, politics moves very quickly. You know, I mean, if you look at Reform, we've gone from 13% at the general election, we've doubled our support in the space of 6 to 8 months. It's astonishing the speed at which politics changes.
In that interview, Aaron Banks also said that he forecast Donald Trump will bring peace to Ukraine within weeks, if not a month or so. Well, almost on cue, Donald Trump yesterday said he's on it. And here is the Donald talking from the White House.
When and where do you plan on meeting with Vladimir Putin? And were there any preconditions set to agree to this meeting?
No, we had a great call, and it lasted for a long time, over an hour. This morning, I also had with President Zelensky a very good call after that. And I think we're on the way to getting peace. I think President Putin wants peace, and President Zelensky wants peace, and I want peace. I just want to see people stop getting killed. We're very far away from that particular war, but that's a vicious war. Probably 1.5 million soldiers killed in a short period of time. I've never seen anything. I have pictures that are, you wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe what you have to look at. Young, beautiful soldiers that are just being decimated. And it would be nice to end it immediately. But we had a very good talk with people didn't really know what President Putin's thoughts were. But I think I can say with great confidence he wants to see it ended also. That's good. And we're going to work toward getting it ended and as fast as possible. It's a horrible situation going over. It's flat land. And the bullet goes off, and the only thing it can hit is a body, a human body, a young human body. And they're losing just tremendous numbers of mostly soldiers. Just the cities and towns have been largely demolished. It's a shame what's happened to that country. It would have never happened if I were president. That I can tell you would have never happened. It's to look at that. And October 7th would have never happened either, by the way, the Middle East. But we'll get it. I think we'll get it. We'll get something done. We're going to be meeting actually tomorrow. They're meeting in Munich, as you know, and we're going to have some other meetings. And I'll be dealing with President Putin largely on the phone. And we ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here and I'll go there. And we're going to meet also probably in Saudi Arabia. The first time we'll meet in Saudi Arabia, see if we can get something done. But we want to end that war. That war is a disaster. It's a really bloody, horrible war.
Saudi Arabia, the first meeting will happen.
I think so. We think we're going to probably meet in Saudi Arabia, the first meeting. Hasn't been set, but not too distant future. We both understand, you know, we know the Crown Prince, and I think it'd be a very good place to meet.
So it sounds like that would just be a meeting between you and Putin and perhaps the Crown Prince, but not President Zelensky?
Probably we'll have a first meeting, and then we'll see what we can do about the second meeting.
Did you also commit to go to Ukraine?
What about Ukraine?
Did you commit to go to Ukraine?
No, I haven't. I haven't committed to
go to
Ukraine. I would think about going. Yeah, I'd think about it. No problem.
Well, not everybody is terribly excited about the potential peace breaking out in Ukraine because there's some noses, particularly European ones, that are out of joint. Our partners at the Financial Times in this morning's FT News briefing focused on this issue. Mark Filippino and Henry Foy have this report.
European countries are trying to figure out what U.S. President Donald Trump wants from a Ukraine peace deal. They're hoping to get more clarity at the Munich Security Conference that starts tomorrow. Here to talk about what might be in store for a peace deal is the FT's Brussels bureau chief, Henry Foy. EU countries don't actually know a ton about what the Trump administration is working on in terms of a peace deal between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. But what do they know?
They know that whatever is being cooked up and whatever Donald Trump is landing on is probably going to have to be paid for by European capitals. And when I say paid for, Mark, what I mean is putting in cash up front to pay for reconstruction, building roads, building housing, and pay for it with physical humans, with troops. Donald Trump has made very clear that there will not be US troops in Ukraine after the war to keep the peace. Now, the real concern here is that Europe is going to be asked to pay for and support a deal that they have zero input into striking. And what they're very worried about is that Trump is going to sort of present it to them as a fait accompli and then go and negotiate it with Putin and possibly Zelensky, but not necessarily over the heads of Europe.
Now, Trump said yesterday that he had spoken to Putin on the phone and that the two of them would actually begin negotiations, quote, immediately. What else did the Trump administration say?
Well, for a while, Trump has been saying, look, Europe needs to take on more responsibility for its own defense. That's sort of morphed in recent days into Europe needs to take more responsibility for Ukraine going forward. Also this week, we, of course, had the release of the U.S. citizen Mark Fogel in Russia. This was a prison swap deal negotiated by one of Trump's associates in Moscow. Europeans, of course, very happy to see a Western citizen go free from a Russian jail. But for them, they read it as, okay, Putin is in a deal-making mood and Trump is ready to do deals. And again, this is another deal that the Europeans were not involved in at all.
Henry, what kind of impact would a Trump-led peace agreement that doesn't really involve the EU have on European security?
Well, Mark, I think if Trump were to say, this is the deal that I've negotiated with Vladimir Putin, and this is the deal you're all going to have to agree to, that would really make a lot of European capitals question just how much they're able to, A, rely upon the United States in the future for any kind of security guarantees to European states. But also, if on top of that, European troops are being made to move into Ukraine by Donald Trump to protect this peace agreement that he's negotiated, what then happens if Russia were to launch an attack in Ukraine? Would America come to their aid? It really does open up a huge number of questions about how Europe sees its future and how much it can rely on America if it's told, you're not allowed to be part of this deal, but I need you to pay for it, execute it, and make sure it holds.
Henry Foy is the FT's Brussels bureau chief. Thanks, Henry.
And those are our partners at the Financial Times in London. Well, before we pick up a clip from my fortnightly chat with Rob Herzog, some news from a by-election, which does give you the temperature gauge of the way people in South Africa are viewing things. And the IFP won handsomely a ward in KwaZulu-Natal, taking it away from the ANC and giving them control of the municipality in that district. The IFP won 60% of the vote, and it was a high poll. More than half of the people who lived in the ward came out and voted. In the previous election, the ANC won 56%. But what is really relevant here was that in the election on the in May last year, Jacob Zuma's MK party won 54% of the votes of the people who live in this area. This time round, only 18. Maybe that shooting star has actually started to come down to earth. But back to local politics and local issues. I asked Rob Herzog in our chat, and that is on the BizNews TV channel, why it was that big business seems to be supporting a pretty destructive stance by the ANC against the Americans, in particular that it is sacrificing the South African economy potentially on the cross of Iran, also on the basis that we are a moral beacon when Iran is anything but that. I'll remind you what Iraj Abedian said in a recent interview this week with Bronwyn Nielsen, that Iran's Nobel Peace Prize winner was jailed in October 2023, and she's still in jail. That's a bit like South Africa putting Archbishop Desmond Tutu in the slammer.
But let's talk about big business. And by the way, I'm going to stop calling corporate South Africa cows and colluders, okay? I had a conversation on Sunday with someone who's been on BizNews a couple of times, a business hero. He runs a business that has 100,000 employees. And he said, Rob, he said, you know, I would love to stand up and do what you're doing. And I'm very proud you do it and you must keep doing it. But corporate South Africa is cornered. Corporate South Africa is the frog in the pot. You know, on every public board, every public company in South Africa is the PIC, which is the government. There's BEE, and BEE are never going to call out the government. I mean, they're just pigs at the trough. There are diversity, you know, directors. And the chief executive of these companies, male, female, whatever color, whatever shape and size, are surrounded by all of these entities that make it almost impossible for them to stand up like I do or you do and call out the government. And so therefore they are currently towing the line on the America thing. They're also very worried about their franchises. A Go is going to get cancelled. All the other agreements are going to cancel. It's going to hit business really hard. It's going to hit farming really hard. It's going to hit the corporate community very hard. And they know it. And they're just trying to survive in their difficult patch. So I apologize to corporate South Africa for my 2 years of calling you cowards and colluders. I hate to say there's nothing you can do, but I know you're cornered and you've got, you know, sword of Damocles, gun to your head, and, you know, these nasty people surrounding you where you can do very little, including the unions. So on that note, I'm going to move on from the corporates. But what can they do? What can they do? They're trapped. Most South Africans are trapped like a frog in a boiling pot, and the pot's getting hotter. The only chance we have of breaking this deadlock that we're caught in is an external force. And that's what's coming. America has had enough. And that's going to create a dynamic. And you know the great expression, never waste a good crisis. Well, we've got one coming and coming soon.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking, out of the ordinary.
During that interview with Rob Herzog, I suggested that it would be great if somebody would go through the State of the Nation addresses by Cyril Ramaphosa and see what he promised since 2018 and what's actually been delivered. Well, community member Dani Mouton did exactly that, and we have the results, which are sobering indeed, very much so for Pretoria, on BizNews today. But we were beaten to the punch, I guess, by the parliamentary leader of Action SA, Athol Trollope, who had some pretty stinging words to say about the President's State of the Nation address. And in the light of failed promises, it's well worth revisiting. He said this earlier in Parliament this week.
Your ANC sins are catching up with you. You have prostituted yourselves to the highest bidders who grease your party wheels with no regard for the consequences. The New World Order sees which side you have picked, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. Javier Milei was unambiguous about this at Davos. Mr. President, your lip service to fighting corruption while promoting and protecting cadres who have failed at local government level, who've been implicated and convicted of egregious corruption and tender fraud, undermines our international reputation. This severely limits our ability to attract foreign direct investment to grow our anemic economy. We have a new generation, a new government, in words, not in deed. There's an interesting article about the changing of the guard in the United States entitled Overrides. It focuses on the dismantling of an entrenched and manifestly corrupt order. It is clear that there's been no override or dismantling of our entrenched corrupt order, as your Sona speech was as delusional, out of touch, and fanciful as ever. Mr. President, you display dystopian disconnection, and I'm not surprised, because your ministers do it every day. Minister Mantashe said, Sizabakupa, when we asked him, when are you going to deal with the Lily Mine victims? It's now been 9 years. We hear that Vantage is going to open the mine. Not a word about the Lily Mine victims. Your police minister informs you that every police station has a victim-friendly service center. They don't. Just ask every single GBV victim who has to go to a police center to report a rape what it feels like. Your Minister of Home Affairs claims to be eradicating backlogs, yet his department cannot resolve a case I've referred to him of two South Africans awaiting passports abroad for more than a year. It's easier for illegal immigrants to infiltrate Home Affairs and bribe their way to obtaining documents that give them access to South African Social Security and other citizenship privileges that our citizens don't have. No, sir, the situation is actually dystopian.
And some business news to end off with. Elon Musk says that Grok GPT-3, which is the artificial intelligence engine that is packaged within Twitter, or now X, will be released in a few weeks. He calls it, as you will hear in a moment, scary smart. Elon joined the World Government Summit in Dubai by satellite. And this happened yesterday.
GPT-3 has very, very powerful reasoning capabilities. In the tests that we've done thus far, GPT-3 is outperforming anything that's been released that we're aware of. That's a good sign. At times I think GPT-3 is kind of scary smart. And you're like, wow, this thing's smart. It's kind of scary. GPT-3 is scary. It's like, wow, this thing's, it comes up with solutions that you didn't even think were, you wouldn't even anticipate, not obvious solutions. So GPT-3 was trained with the most amount of compute, and I think very efficiently trained. Also notably, GPT-3 was trained on a lot of synthetic data. So then it goes back and forth through the data and tries to achieve logical consistency. So if it's got data that is wrong, it'll actually reflect upon that and remove the data that is wrong, that does not concord with reality. So its base reasoning is very good. In fact, the even without fine tuning, GPT-3, the base model, is better than GPT-2. So we're really in the final stages of polishing GPT-3. Probably it gets released in about a week or two. So pretty soon. I don't want to be hasty in the release, because a lot of the final polish is necessary for a great user experience. In some ways you can think of it like a house. That last 5% where you do finish the drywall and do the painting and the trimming, even though it's not much work, it transforms the house.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure that last 5% is done really well. It's a week, maybe 2 weeks. I think it'll be very good. And I think this might be, we think it'll be better than anything else. And then maybe this might be the last time that any AI is better than Grok.
Well, thanks for being with us for the briefing. And we'll be back again on Monday. My colleague, Bronwyn Nielsen, taking the chair for the whole of next week, as I will be, as mentioned earlier, at the ARC Summit in the UK. Until the next time, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.